My name is Ron, and I'm an alcoholic and a connoisseur of numerous other fine chemicals. Once again, on the behalf of the committee, welcome to San Diego and to our breakfast meeting. We have a few announcements this morning before our meeting will open. That the East Room in the White House has been reserved, and that a small vehicle from Cape Canaveral will be used for the finale. It's also to be announced that next year's spring meeting will not be held in Morristown. That instead, the spring meeting will be held in San Antonio, and that Dr. Gene Seal will be chairing that meeting and looks forward to contacting each of you and to having a good turnout for that meeting. Dr. Seal, are you in the audience? Would you stand, please? I guess not. Our Bissell is trying to have the privilege of standing here before you with a red dot on my badge. 2 years ago, I was at the peak of my illness. I was so delighted to meet you wonderful people and to find out that I was an alcoholic and an addict and a person, and that you treated me with love and told me that there was hope. I no longer had to identify myself as having some sort of syndrome. Actually, not being a psychiatrist, I thought that a syndrome was a brothel in which they competed. It's been a treat and a delight for me to relive my experience with you, with the enormous number of newcomers that are here. Newcomers, you keep us alive. You keep us young. And we want you to come back again, 100% of you, next year, and help us to grow as exponentially as I've seen this organization grow in my short contact with it. Come and bring two or three or six newcomers with you. And now I'd like to open this meeting. By reading our preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics achieve sobriety. I feel very personally grateful during this convention to share with you the things that have been so important to me in my sobriety. You're seeing the people who have surrounded me and helped me, the lovely city in which I live. This morning's speaker is someone who has helped me to know my higher power on a friendly, loving basis as a resource I never knew I possessed. Father Terry Ritchie is dearly beloved in this area for the work that he's done among many alcoholics. He comes to us from the Los Angeles area, where he's a member of a five-man intervention team and an advisory panel on alcoholism for the Archdiocese of Los Angeles, a board member for the National Clergy Council on Alcoholism, and the director of numerous retreats for alcoholics and co-alcoholics. Father Terry was a little bit anxious about addressing you this morning. He said to me that he didn't know what he could possibly say to follow Shamu, I said, I don't care what you say, but perhaps if you dress the same. Father Terry.
Very good. My name is Terry, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Terry.
Not bad for an Italian. I'm an alcoholic, and I'm sober, and I'm delighted. I'm very grateful. I was drawn towards the program in such a way that my higher power had a chance. He gave me a chance. Really, I can't complain. He gave me a good chance to figure out how to stay sober with just the usual mass of help of society. He did me two favors. He let me know what alcoholism is, basically, and he let me know that I had it. Then he said, take it away. And six hospitalizations later, this is after I knew better, and after being fired for life twice, I got here with ready to pay attention, and not ready to pay attention with any type of hope or good cheer or expectation of wonderful things. Just ready to pay attention because all my bright ideas had been pounded out of me. I didn't have any other place to go at the time. I was in a recovery house that required 4 AA meetings a week in order to be fed. So I went. I have two thoughts in my head here at the beginning. One is that from Captain Persh's description of the everyman alcoholic physician, the peculiar deformation of the psyche that goes along with the average alky addict doctor, I figure I missed my vocation. I identified fully, down to the family with the very high ideals, and an alcoholic father. And I also grew up with this fantastic education in alcoholism. And my my story as an alcoholic and recovering alcoholic might be summarized as a confirmation of what I consider one of the understatements of the 20th century. We find in the big book, and I'm not going to quote it verbatim, I don't know it verbatim, but it's put succinctly in one place and in many places in more and more drawn out fashion, namely that we discovered that self-knowledge is not enough. Insight doesn't do it. I'm here. I will now elaborate on that. My insight started early. As many of you, I was kind of a smart kid, and I listened. My father went to AA meetings in the early 40s in Los Angeles, 2200 Club next to MacArthur Park. He was found dead in a dryout place on his 42nd birthday, Vermont Avenue in Los Angeles. I was 6 years old. But even at that time, we already had all the sayings of AA in the family vocabulary. I already knew that I should live one day at a time. Easy does it. I knew that alcoholism was a disease. I knew that once an alky, always an alky. I knew the first drink got you drunk. And I was fascinated with all that. I was told not to think badly of my father and my uncles, to say a prayer for them. And I prayed. A few uncles were alcoholic, and they added to my education. We had a policy in our house that my Uncle Bill and my Uncle Matt were always welcome, no matter how drunk and dirty, as long as they stayed in the boys' room in the garage and the army bunk beds. And if they made the run again, then they got the formal expulsion orders. I can remember one of my little sisters, Kathy, commenting to my Uncle Bill as he was being escorted across the backyard after he had made the run. She said, "If that's a disease you got, don't come back, because I don't want to catch it." So we were very sophisticated on these matters. I decided to outwit all the ambiguities and problems of life by becoming a good boy. And I devoted myself to it. I went to the seminary to study to be a priest, and about that time was confirmed. There was an Irish bishop who encouraged us all to take the pledge and not to drink till we were 21. I took him up on that, and I not only took the pledge, but I kept it. And mostly because I think everybody was out of stubbornness, kind of an alcoholic stubbornness, perhaps. All of my classmates says, "Nobody keeps the pledge. Don't worry about it." So I said, "I'm going to keep it." So I went ahead in my education. The longest paper I wrote in college was on alcoholism. I read the big book, the stories, and a number of other books on this disease 2 years before I had a drink. So when I began drinking in a setting that the National Council of Alcoholism couldn't ask any more. By way of preparation for their first drink. There I was, a student in the seminary. By the way, it's not against my religion to drink. Moving about here the last day, it looks like some of you were sinners from the start. I just wanted to drink like the other Catholics. That's another thing, another rumor I might try to scotch here while I have the podium, that not all Catholics are alcoholic. That's been circulating some meetings. Anyway, I began drinking in a setting that, to say the least, was ideal. I didn't have any money to speak of. I didn't have any friends who caroused. I had a head full of knowledge in alcoholism, and it was in the summertime. I was glad of that. We got out in the summer, and my birthday rolled around, and I went to the store. I bought a bottle of bourbon, sweet vermouth, Angostura bitters, maraschino cherries. I got the Southern Comfort recipe book out of Newsweek. The one that they staple in the middle periodically. Now, an ounce and a half of this and three quarters of an ounce of that. I computed out the recipe, made a batch of Manhattans, and discovered America. Drinking was a big deal to me from the start. It's a big deal now, it was then, and I wish to God it weren't at that time. I knew right away that it should not be a big deal. Well, I should be casual about this. There's a definition of an alcoholic I like a lot. It says, an alcoholic is somebody who is always wanting a drink or wanting not to drink and pretending to be indifferent. I've never been indifferent. And I've always tried to look indifferent. I had a few Manhattans that day, and we talk about crossing the invisible line. Some people drink for a good number of years, and they look, their drinking doesn't look particularly different from anyone else's, or at least certainly doesn't seem to be causing particular problems. And then something happens, and there's problems, and then they never go back across the line. Some people cross the line early. I'm pretty sure that I crossed the line sometime in the early afternoon of my 21st birthday. There was no waiting. One of the reactions I had that day that I consider a very clear symptom of the disease of alcoholism was that after having a drink and having my tummy warm up and that tightness in my chest loosen up and my IQ go up about 20 points, and feeling that gaining a deeper respect for my father and my uncles. And I won't say feeling happy. Booze never made me happy. It always made me feel like I was going to be happy in about 15 minutes. But after all that, I decided not to tell anybody how much I liked Manhattans. I decided that they're going to be checking up on my drinking soon enough, and I am not going to help them. I am not going to give them any free ammunition. So I didn't say anything. I did look around, and I think I maybe confused this reaction kind of built as time went on. I don't know how much I felt of that day. But I did notice very early those other people with a drink in their hand and wondering, why are they pretending that they're not feeling what I feel? I wasn't asking why I was pretending that I didn't feel what I was feeling. Well, but I caught that they weren't. They just didn't look like they appreciated what they had at all. Either they were into deep deception or lacked some capacity to appreciate God's greatest gift. But that was something I noticed early. As I looked around with other people with a drink, I could tell they were into something different than what I was into. And so we were in different activities. We looked the same. A photograph would show the same thing. We both had a drink in our hand. But they were at a party, and they happened to be having a drink. I was drinking, and I happened to be at the party. And this is the root, I think, of my own alcoholism. I value a high. I value it more than I value whatever else you put up against it. And you could say to me, gee, you say that with so sensuously. You know, didn't you go to school? Don't you have any standards? I have standards. I went to school, and I value a high on alcohol. I have good reason to believe that my alcoholism is progressing as most other people's alcoholism is progressing. And so I probably value a high more now than I've ever had. You say, well, why? I don't know why. I just do. That's my premise. You know, that's the given in this problem. But I do like to speculate. I always apologize before I go into this speculation, because this kind of sharing in this setting, we usually discourage speculation and why questions. If you're new, you've probably already been warned not to ask any why questions. We don't tolerate that for a couple of years. You may ask how. We are encouraged to ask how. We tolerate what questions and absolutely forbid why questions. Why do I value a hyla as much as I do? Well, then you can go into the proximate stuff. I have a physical constitution that is such that I don't get sleepy right away when I start drinking or I throw up. I don't get distressed that way. I get a kick out of it. That's one thing. But the deeper thing, I think the deeper thing has something to do with the spiritual experience. I think being high on alcohol is the closest thing to a spiritual experience that isn't. It's just about exactly the opposite of one, actually, but it feels like one's coming on. There's an experience of transcendence. I was asked by my sponsor. He said, "Father, have you ever felt close to God?" Kind of a nervy question. And I thought it was a trick question, so I didn't answer it right away. I waited a little while, and I was careful. And I said, "Yes, I think I felt close to God." He said, "When you felt close to God, would it be fair to say that you had the feeling that everything was all right?" And I said, "That's kind of a bland expression, everything is all right. But yes, I'll go for that. There was a definite feeling that I'm still a jerk and the world's full of troubles, but life is going on and love is going on and everything's all right." Yeah, that's sort of a sense of spiritual stance, attitude, experience. And then I got to thinking, when I have a few quick double scotches, I had the feeling that everything was all right. Because I got the chemical transcendence. And I don't sneeze at this. I don't say, "Well, dummy, it was just chemical. So why, grow up." Because that's the way I always talked to myself before. I always despised myself for the root of my alcoholism. I despised myself because I valued that feeling as I did. I despised myself so deeply, of course, that I would figure out that I really didn't like it that much. And that this is a temporary moral aberration. With a few more prayers, I will heighten my consciousness, deepen my awareness, and get good. And won't have these attacks of fantasizing how to have a drink on the way home from an AA meeting. I think that most alcoholics in this country are regular folks going around trying their best to do the impossible. Trying very hard to get over something that isn't to be gotten over. Now, we have a lot of education along this line now. We all hear about alcoholism and once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic, and it never goes away, and it's not a moral issue. It's just a condition, a metabolic condition, and relax, folks, don't worry about it. Doesn't mean you're a monster. All of that's true. And no drinking alcoholic believes it at all. Every drinking alcoholic will say, "Yes, I agree to that." But I think while I was a drinking alcoholic, with, I think, an above average pile of information on the disease inside of me, I was able to say, "Of course, I'm an alcoholic. I'll never be able to live normally if there's drinking in my life. The first drink gets me drunk." Should anybody know the first drink gets you drunk? I was a booze fighter. Go for a couple of weeks and have one drink, and it was a different world I was in. I knew that. But in spite of that pamphlet level knowledge of the situation, I was deeply, I wouldn't say convinced. There was a sense that I simply had to get over the way my head worked, or it was all over. I had to fix my head. I had to get it worked out in such a way. I think some more insights would do it, or more prayers, or more something. I had to get my head overhauled to the extent that I would be high-minded enough not to be plotting after a drink, not to be as susceptible to obsession as I was. I had to become high-minded. And oh Lord, what a burden that is to carry around. I haven't become high-minded. That was the great good news of coming into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, was with my ambition to be transformed so that I would automatically not only not drink, not only be sober. I thought, oh, anybody, I'm not going to settle for that. I want to be sober and know why I'm sober and feel right about it. I thought I had to feel right about it, and you laughed your heads off. What do you mean feel right about it? You're an alcoholic. There's going to be times when all you want is a drink. The good news is you don't have to have one. You get to be sober one day at a time as long as you are willing, fully willing, to feel like a fool, to feel like a jerk who is slavering after a drink in the middle of an AA meeting, figuring that, well, if I just have a half pint tonight, I've been good for a while, and if I just have a few tonight, taper off in the morning, and I haven't had any for so long, I'll be good as new by this tomorrow afternoon. Now, that's so manifestly insane for anybody with the experience we have that when I had those sort of obsessions, I would drink out of sheer humiliation that I had the thought. This kind of ran away from this. I'd like to complete a thought that started out here about that spiritual experience. I think that when a person's condition, the contrast between being half gassed and into surrender, on how the feelings are remarkably similar in some respects. And the state is exactly the opposite. I'm fascinated by that. I think it's just something else. I already described a little bit how the states are similar. And the way they are different is comes across most clearly to me when I consider the way I relate to other people in both states. When I've had a few drinks, I'm never in worse shape to meet people. And I really like to meet people. I have a few drinks. I'm ready to commune with the universe. You know? I'm out there ready to get it on. But what I do is go out and get very busy with my drinking project. Now, I don't know about you, but when I drink, it requires all of my attention and energy. When I drink, I have to constantly recompute the situation. I am computing. I have to make sure that I get enough to drink to do the trick and not too much to screw it up. And I'm in order to make sure that I am getting enough to do the trick, I am taking into account the percentage of alcohol in the drink that I'm working on, and the amount of time I've taken to drink it, and how many ounces, and the liver takes care of so much per hour, and then I've got to make sure about the future and the supply situation. And this picture changes hour to hour, you know. And I have to keep the computations up to the minute. This takes a large part of my mind. But that's minor compared to the project I have when drinking of keeping all of you in the right place. I have to make sure you are thinking good things about me. That means every move I make, every gesture, word, I don't have to be perfect. I know that. You know, we're artists. We have a little shadow in the picture. It isn't that I have to make sure you think I'm wonderful. I just have to make sure that you think I'm doing well enough so that you don't have to do anything that's going to make it more difficult for me to get a drink. That's the bottom line here. And so I'm constantly maneuvering and making little moves to convince you that I'm doing well enough. Now, this even includes when I would be your counselor. I counseled many people after a swig of scope. And while doing that, it looked, you probably thought you were being counseled. You weren't being counseled. What was happening was that I was playing counselor. And I had to listen to your problem in order to play counselor well. I had to listen to what you were saying and get enough of your story so that my responses would be appropriate, as we say. Appropriate enough to convince you were getting a good deal by coming to talk to me. Now, it would have been nice if I actually cared what was happening to you. When I'm drinking, I'm just too busy. I'm too busy to actually go across that line and actually care or get involved with your situation. So what I do is I play adequate. I do a little playlet of being adequate and work very hard at it. It takes up all my energy. So I don't have anything left over to give you. Not only that, it's the energy problem, and it's also a security problem. But when I'm drinking, 95% of the action inside of me is top secret material. I can't tell you anything. I can't tell you what I'm doing or planning. If you said, well, what are you up to today? I'd have to say, well, I'm sitting here plotting out the day's drinking. Wondering if I'm going to make the run before lunch or I'm going to wait till after. My funds are running low, and I do like to maintain a little class and drink scotch, but white port from Thrifty's drugstore is very cost effective. It's you know, you might look down on white port in the abstract, but when it comes to getting the job done, it must be considered, especially. So I can't tell anybody that. You know, you just can't say those things. But that's what's important to me. That's the thing on my agenda. And if I have to talk about just things that aren't important, it's boring. Very boring. Not in good shape to meet people. I can't tell anybody how I feel when I'm drinking. Can you imagine us telling? We're much too polite to tell people how we feel. If someone were asked me, you're looking a little peaked. How you feeling? If I were honest, I'd say something like, well, I feel like an inexorable and irreversible process of disintegration has taken hold. and I'll be dead soon. Well, how are you doing? See, too polite. Sometimes you'll be talking to somebody, and the person you're talking to is ready for you. They're mature, intelligent, and loving, and have the time. Well, when you're talking to somebody like that, you can't tell them the truth either. Because if you do, they'll try to help you. And it's a lot harder to get a drink when they're trying to help you than any other time. That's the merest sketch of the communication problem I have when booze is anywhere in my life. I'm not talking about being drunk. I'm talking about drinking the way I drink. And if I might, with Sunday morning and having on one of my babies who plays jazz, calls my gig suit. I could say I drink idolatrously. I drink with a level of attention that shouldn't be given to that, can't be given to that, you know, without making a religion out of that. Anyway, and the opposite thing of what we'd call a real spiritual condition or experience, I'm never in better shape to meet people. And a spiritual experience, the spiritual condition, you know, what is that? God talk and spiritual talk has fallen into disrepute. I guess it's always falling into disrepute, you know. Most of us people in the profession, we tend to talk as if God's our uncle and I know him and you don't. People become skeptical. And if we're around the program and in the program for a while, we begin to run into people living a spiritual life. And it doesn't look churchy, usually. It doesn't seem to matter. But also, once you find out how everyday and how real faith and the spiritual life is, it's almost a disappointment to find out that a lot of people go to church who are like that. Anyway, what I consider a typical good spiritual condition is that of an alcoholic going to an AA meeting, of an Al-Anon going to an Al-Anon meeting. And let me just flesh out a bit the way I picture the condition in which this person finds herself on the way to the meeting. If a person's going to the meeting, that usually means they already found out some time back that they're never ever going to be happy. They were pretty sure for years they weren't going to be happy, but they had a slight suspicion there was a chance. And then when they just about, when everything ran, broke down, fell apart, when they finally became really convinced, no doubt about it, I've had it. Well, then you can go to a meeting because you won't miss anything. That's the thing I hated most about me. The thought of going to meetings was, you know, something might break while I might have some breakthrough or something wonderful might happen, but it's not going to happen there. We're not the type of people who've spent much time fantasizing, sitting in folding chairs in a church basement is our idea of fulfillment and happiness. Or after the meeting, sitting in a 24-hour coffee shop with Formica tables, dribbling water down those little hot water pots that always dribble. You're trying to make sanka. It dribbles up your arm and onto the table. Sitting between two people you don't like. You were thought you were going to get to sit next to that person you like. I wanted to talk to, and they're at the next table. The booth wasn't big enough. And there you are. Now, usually a person there is in a magnificent spiritual condition because they're so sure nothing good will happen. They don't put any demands on the people around them. They're ready to be bored to death. They figure that's what happens when you get to this stage. When they finally get you and you finally got to be good, it's going to be boring. Here I am. And usually, since I don't expect anything and don't demand or push or pull, I'm ready. I'm actually ready to notice what's good about a person. And as soon as I notice what's good about you, you think I'm smart. And we start talking like human beings. And that's the condition that's a spiritual condition. Anyway, I feel like I've been giving you a lot of advice here. I really did drink there. I'm very grateful to report that my drinking was relatively brief. I guess my total quantity didn't set any records at all. But I drank a bit before I was ordained a priest. Once I was ordained, I got to drink more because you're allowed to. It went very fast. I was a booze fighter very quickly, trying my best to fit in and do my job, getting up at 6, sticking close to home, but starting to have blackouts. Also, the great backfiring experience of trying to control drinking. I had this thing where I used to try to drink one drink per hour on occasion. Usually it was in repentance after I drank too much. The next time out, I'd say drink one drink per hour. You'll never get drunk that way, they say. They may be right. I made that resolution a good number of times and usually did not keep it. It didn't make me feel terribly bad when I didn't keep it. I figure it was pretty good of me to make the resolution. But it didn't demoralize me too much. I kind of felt the same. But when I did keep it, that was alarming. When I did keep it, that was alarming because I'm an alcoholic and I was imitating a social drinker. You know, anybody can get drunk. You can get enough booze into somebody in the required amount of time, they'll get drunk. But you've got to be an alcoholic. To go to a social gathering, drink one drink per hour, be the perfect guest, talk about what they want to talk about, be a big relief to the host, and have a nervous breakdown, which is usually my reaction. I quit drinking to save myself the trouble of becoming an alcoholic, about 4 or 5 months into that, decided, fantastic, you've got the talent to quit. Isn't that wonderful? I didn't think I did. Nobody else was impressed. They figured it's a free country, I didn't have to drink. I was very impressed. I was so impressed with my ability to stop that I decided to start, knowing that if there was any trouble, I would simply use my talent and quit again. And then was into booze fighting in a more serious way. I quit a lot after that, starting and stopping, and then decided that my trouble was that I quit too much. I was, if you quit for life more than 10 times a month, it affects your morale. You begin to. I thought, I'll, what I should do is accept myself, be realistic. I became very idealistic and perfectionistic and so forth in the seminary. I've got to accept myself as a regular human being. I'm a drinking man, and just be cool. Settle down and quit losing your head. So with that thing, on that, with that approach, I bought my fifth of scotch every day. And this lasted a number of months until I was missing things and getting in trouble with my boss and then saying I wouldn't drink and drinking again and missing things and being in trouble with his boss. And finally, I was fired. And I started into aversion treatment. That was the treatment of choice in the place I happened to be at that time. And many of you are familiar with that, nausea drug and warm salt water and a lot to drink. Five of those treatments are supposed to impress a person so much that if they have any motivation left to be sober, that should get them through. One or two extra should do it for life easy. I've had 23 aversion treatments. So. And they asked me never ever to come back there again. I was demoralizing the other patients. And we're kind of back to the pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization that chapter 3 talks about. I was in it. I was in it knowing, you know, the knowledge by this time had built up. I was always hospitalized as an alcoholic, talking to counselors and saying my prayers, praying for God's help. And I got in, so I started going to meetings and said, Father, didn't you pray to your higher power? Yes, I was praying to my higher power. I was praying to my higher power to what I figured the deal was that I was going to be stuck with the label alcoholic for the rest of my life. I agreed to that. That to my family, it was kind of respectable to be an alcoholic anyway. I'll buy that one. But somehow I had to get over this condition. I had to get over being me. I had to undergo a radical overhaul that would make me so different than I am. I was like a man who had lost his legs and was praying for new ones. And I was very cynical, not having received an affirmative answer. No new legs, huh? Well, if that's the way you treat your clergy, no wonder they're not coming to church. I found this thing of self-will run riot. That's a wonderful phrase. Bill Wilson's deathless phrases. And I found that self-will run riot in the pursuit of virtue is much more dangerous than self-will run riot in the pursuit of vice. Usually when you're up to no good, you kind of know it. But when you're hot on the pursuit of virtue, God help the neighborhood. Our Father who art in heaven, my will be done on earth. It's easy to get confused there. I mean, if you're not confused still, I'd like to talk to you after the meeting. Seems like, you know, if God doesn't want you to be sober, if God doesn't want you to be a good doctor, well, what does he want? Doesn't he want that? I used to think that way. I'd pray to be a good priest. But my prayers always had secret clauses. They were so secret, they were secret from me. And my clauses went like this. When I would say, God, please help me be sober, my secret clause would be, and the way I'll know you're helping me is when I notice that I'm comfortable every minute. I mean, wouldn't he want to give me a quality sobriety? God, please help me be a good priest. In secret clause, and the way I'll know you're helping me is when I notice that I'm better than the other ones. Just a little ego there and the old humble prayer. And I think this willfulness and ego, it wells up eternally. It goes on and on. For me, I'm getting into the we there, but it does in you too, I'm sure of that. This thing of my will under the guise of good works and high-mindedness is with me all the time, all the time. And the only hope that I have of keeping in reasonable touch with my own deviousness and to keep in reasonable touch with a way of life that is spiritual is to be in constant touch with you, to be listening to your sharing so that I can identify with your deviousness and say, oh yes, oh Lord, there I go again. No, I absolutely need it. People have asked me at times, well, what about this religion versus AA? Within me, though, there's no versus whatever. I'm an alcoholic. I need the full, unmitigated, undiluted program of the 12 steps and the fellowship to be in good enough shape to go to church. To be in good enough shape not to twist. My religion's fine. I feel much more comfortable with it than I did a few years ago. It was 10 years ago. But I need this as a preamble. And the kind of faith, it's wonderfully American. I think AA had a start here. So pragmatic. It doesn't give a little sermon first about faith. It says, we're not even going to talk to you. From the looks of you, you're not really, it doesn't look like a conversation is going to go far. So why don't you just be quiet and come along and do this stuff that people with faith do. And if you do the stuff that people with faith do for a while, the transformation starts. The pragmatic approach, live as if you're not the center of the universe. And that's what I was invited to do, maybe not in those words, but I begin to be with people who were aware that their sobriety was a gift. And if there's a gift, there's some giver in somehow or some way. People living in grace, people living with a sense of great good fortune. And then people living with such a friendliness with the truth that we're able to gradually let down and be the neurotic, immature, childish people we are so that we can keep on the journey and grow up. I am just appalled at my progress. Anybody could have gone faster than this. Anybody. It's just shocking. And of course, and every time I have those insights pile up, of course everyone says, gee, you're looking terrific. Doing wonderful work, da 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 da. But my hour's about up. And by the design of this program, there's a lot of people who are really want to run to your room right now. If you didn't make it after breakfast, I bet you're really ready to go. I am grateful to be sober, and I am full of an awareness that I am being held in sobriety and being given life and health. That I'm somebody who's now receiving, and that this awareness is in direct contrast to the ideal I carried around in my head as I grew up. The ideal of being self-sufficient with God's help, you know, asterisk. Of being the person who gets it all together. I don't have it all together at all, but I am with you in the fellowship of the Spirit and very grateful to be sober. Thank you.
Love you, Terry.
We're concluding the 30th meeting of IDAA. Thank you for sharing with us. Dr. Milner, thank you for your brilliance in bringing us together this year and for making this such a celebration. Please remember to see LeClaire Bissell about the regional meetings, sign up for your tapes with Jerry McCracken. Stay and enjoy our fine city if you can. And see us next year in Washington and bring someone with you. God love you all. Father Terry, will you lead us in the Lord's Prayer?
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever.
Amen.
Amen.
Thank you.
Well, thank you.